Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
Joe is filling in for Julie this week. You probably know Joe from Forward Thinking, our sister podcast and show brand. And we're talking about the eclipse.
The eclipse.
Yes, the power of eclipse.
The nicotine gum.
Oh, it's...
Wait,
is that the name of the
No, wait, is it? I think it might just be a regular gum.
Oh, okay. Maybe available in nicotine flavor. I don't know.
No, eclipses... are a thing that they are both sort of mundane in physical terms,
yeah,
but also quite stunning and terrifying and significant throughout the history of humanity.
Yeah, significant to the observer.
Yeah, because I just want to try to imagine. I know you can't really put yourself in this headspace, but just try to imagine what it would be like to sort of live in a pre-scientific time. Maybe you're part of a, you know, a hunter-gatherer tribe somewhere in the world. And for the first time in your life, something very strange happens one day. The sky starts to go dark, and you see a black disk pass in front of the sun until there's just a ring of white fire, and the it's dark in the middle of the daytime. You don't know what's going on or what's causing this. I have to imagine that it would be absolutely terrifying and completely bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, the cycle of night and day, you know, one of the guiding factors of your life. I mean, really, the guiding factors for any organism.
Yeah.
Some of the earliest organisms were still based on recognizing when it was dark and when it was daylight. And suddenly, that seems to be thrown out the window by this random chaotic event.
Yeah, well, I'd say upsetting the clear division between night and day is like one of the most perverse things you could do to a biological organism. I mean, the sun, it's the mother of all on Earth. When you think about it, all energy on Earth is solar energy, pretty much. All the energy we consume, you know, all the food we eat is it a few steps down the chain, but it's solar energy. And so it's just kind of amazing to imagine not knowing what's going on, but seeing that mother of all life suddenly blotted out. And of course, maybe not equally astounding, but also very strange and perhaps perverse and upsetting is the lunar eclipse. seeing something happen to the moon, which to you might have been some kind of god or have some other kind of magical significance, seeing it change colors or seeing a shadow pass in front of it. So, yeah, I think eclipses are going to be a really interesting thing to talk about. So you might have heard a couple of years ago that the Mayan calendar predicted the end of the world. You remember this?
I remember hearing a little about it. Yeah.
Yeah, there was,
I think, one or two
way
news,
too much about it.
Sources picked up on it.
Oh, I got so sick of hearing about that. But maybe it's just now been long enough that we can bring it up again without making people groan too much. But it was supposed to end in December 2012. Well, not only did the world not end, but the Mayan calendar actually, this is funny, didn't predict the end of the world. Did you know this at the time?
I don't think I was that informed about it. But I was just bombarded with that idea of, you know, Mayan apocalypse.
Yeah. So around that time was basically the end of their long calendar cycle, which would reset afterwards. So it wasn't really a judgment day. It was more like their December 31st, if they had a really, really, really long year.
Yeah, it would be like somebody looking back at our calendar system and thinking of the end of the year is the end of an era, the end of an age, an apocalypse.
Right. And so they didn't predict the end of the world there, but the Mayan astronomical calendar actually did make some interesting astronomical predictions. For example, there's a book called Astronomy in the Maya Codices by Harvey and Victoria Bricker. So they discuss the ancient Mayan astronomical calendars, and they discuss them dating back to the 11th or 12th centuries CE, and they say that these ancient calendars that the Maya had predict the date of a solar eclipse that would have been visible in July of 1991 within about a day of accuracy. And it kind of makes you wonder why predicting an eclipse would be that important to them. I mean, it's not like it had any real, like, physical effects of much significance on Earth. You know, it didn't, like, it wasn't that an eclipse would, like, destroy all their crops or something. So what did it mean?
Well, a lot of it really comes down to, of course, just cosmology, your understanding of what you are as a people and what the world is and then what the cosmos means, as well as just basic record keeping, basic observation of the movement of the spheres, and using this as a way to divide out time. The ancient Maya believed in recurring cycles of creation and destruction, and they believed that life was composed of eras lasting around in modern years it would be around a 5,200 year periods. They believed in a flat four cornered Earth that was has been described as being like that of the back of a crocodile that's resting in the water. You know, where
that's
just
awesome.
The back is emerging. And, you know, there was, you know, additional stuff about the four corners and the corresponding gods. And of course, there are also a lot of rituals in life that are dictated by this 260-day sacred round calendar. So within Mayan culture, you have these priests. These are the guys that are tasked with taking care of upkeep of the calendar as well as astronomy. So they're calculating time. They're figuring out when festivals should occur, when ceremonies are occurring, certain fateful days and seasons. They're divining the future. They're trying to figure out the cures for diseases. They're writing about it all, and they're keeping track of the various genealogies. So in a sense, they're the keepers of time. They are concerned with Mayan time and the Mayan people's place in the universe.
Yeah, and obviously to the Maya, astronomical events had real significance. Like they might believe that an astronomical portent could give them real information about what would happen to them. You know, like it could bring something bad that would be dangerous, or it could bring a good omen. So you actually really wanted to be able to predict and understand astronomical events. And of course, the Maya weren't the only ones who had beliefs like this. This is very common all around the world. Like the ancient Chinese were very concerned with being able to predict eclipses. Even the Antikythera mechanism.
Oh yes,
this is sometimes referred to as the world's first computer, or like the oldest astronomical calculator in existence. It's a mechanical computer that's, you know, I think more than 2,000 years old. Mm-hmm. That was discovered in a shipwreck in the Mediterranean, off the coast, I believe, of the island Antikythera. Mm-hmm. And so they bring this thing up, and people have been studying it and putting together reconstructions of it. And what the people who have studied this mechanism decided is that, so this was an ancient astronomical calculator that if you wound the gears, it would tell you the placement of different celestial objects, and it would predict eclipses. So the ancient Greeks or whoever invented this amazingly advanced mechanism for the time were also very concerned with being able to know when was an eclipse going to happen.
So we're going to come back and discuss the human significance of eclipse more in a few minutes. But first, we really need to break down the basic science of the eclipse, the basic celestial mechanics that are in play here.
Okay, Robert, tell me a word that's hard to pronounce.
I can probably stumble over any number of difficult words to pronounce, but the one in question here is Zizigi, which is
Zizigi.
Zizigi, which is Syzygy, which is...
it's like they were playing a joke on you.
Yeah, I mean, and it only just makes me think of Ziggy, the cartoon character.
Yeah.
It comes from...
Or Ziggy Stardust.
That's, why am I going to Ziggy the cartoon character instead of Bowie? I don't know. But it comes from the Greek Zizyogos, which means yoke together. Because ultimately we are talking about convergence here, right?
Yeah.
So every eclipse is a Zizigi, but not every Zizigi is an eclipse. When a Zizigi occurs with celestial bodies, we're talking about a nearly straight line configuration of three celestial bodies. In this case, we're talking about configurations that involve the sun, moon, and the earth lining up within a gravitational system. It also refers to when the sun and the moon are in conjunction, such as a new moon, or in opposition, a full moon. So those are examples. Those a full moon is a Zizigi, but obviously a full moon is not necessarily an eclipse.
Okay.
But you need a full moon for a lunar eclipse, but more on that later.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So I get that. So Zizigi.
Yes.
It's from the Greek. Where does the word eclipse come from?
Well, with eclipse, we have to go back to the Greek as well, back to eclipsis from eclipion, which means to omit, fail, suffer, etc.
Man.
See, but this kind
That's
of...
dire.
I mean, it kind of drives home the fact that throughout human history, like, this is how we view eclipse. It is a thing of dire omen.
Totally. Well, okay, let's look at how lunar eclipses work first, and then we can turn to solar eclipses. Okay, so pop quiz, which is which? You know that one is the Earth blocking light from reflecting off the moon,
mm-hmm.
and the other is the moon blocking the direct light from the sun that we receive on Earth. But which is which?
Oh, I mean, so you're basically for a solar eclipse to occur, the moon has to be in the way.
Right. So for a solar eclipse, the easy way to remember is that you're naming the object that's being obscured.
Okay.
So for a solar eclipse, that's blocking the light from the sun. The lunar eclipse is blocking the reflected light from the moon.
Okay.
So the lunar eclipse happens. It's actually, in the most basic terms, really simple. It's when the moon passes into the shadow of Earth. And when we describe these, it'll probably really help we'll try to do our best, but if you look at a picture, this is inherently kind of a geometrical or visual phenomenon. You can only say so much with words. But if you picture the Earth orbiting the sun and then the moon orbiting the Earth, every now and then the orbits line up so that the moon is directly behind the Earth with respect to the sun. And of course, the light we see from the moon doesn't come from the moon. It's reflected from the sun. So if you block the light, you know, with the Earth's shadow, you're going to not see much light reflected from the moon, or you're going to see maybe some strange colors.
So it's like standing in front of a movie projection camera facing the screen, and you're suddenly asking yourself, where did the movie go? Well, the movie's on your back now because you're standing in front of the projector.
That's a good analogy. Okay. So the Earth, there are two cone-shaped shadows that come off of the Earth. And one is sort of the outward-spreading one, and one is sort of the inward-focusing one. The outward-spreading one is known as the penumbra. That's the more diffuse shadow. So that's kind of a faint shadow. And you've probably seen, you know, yourself in various scenarios that you're actually casting sort of more than one shadow, kind of a faint, bigger shadow, and then a smaller, more concentrated shadow. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the middle focused inner shadow is the umbra, and that's going to be the very dark area that the Earth is blocking out a big majority of the sun's light. The penumbra encases the umbra. So the penumbra is wide, the umbra is small in the middle of that. It's the little bullseye there in the umbra. Because a lunar eclipse can only happen when the moon is behind the Earth, that means that a lunar eclipse also only happens during a full moon. A full moon is when the, you know, the moon is behind the Earth, reflecting its full face to the Earth. It's, mm-hmm. it's not getting partially out of view. But the moon orbits the Earth all the time. Like, it makes a full circle roughly every month, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we see a lunar eclipse every full moon? Why don't we see a lunar eclipse every time the moon is on the opposite side of the Earth? So you can imagine the Earth and the sun together on what's called an ecliptic plane. They're sort of like sitting on a flat surface together.
Right.
You imagine that's a flat surface. And the moon actually does not orbit the Earth on exactly that same plane.
Okay.
It's not flat with the sun and the Earth. It's at a 5-degree angle from that orbit. So if you can imagine this, and it probably, again, will help if you look at a picture, the Earth's orbiting the sun on a flat plane, and then the moon is orbiting the Earth slightly diagonally. So every now and then it is just lined up on the sort of up and down y-axis with where the sun and the Earth are, and other times it's above or below.
Okay, so the rotation of the Earth is like a brimmed hat that's just on perfectly, whereas the moon's rotation is a cocked hat.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So those places where the moon crosses the ecliptic plane of the sun and the Earth, those are called nodes, and that's where it's lined up correctly to be caught right in the middle of the possible eclipse shadow that's being cast by the Earth. When those orbits line up perfectly like that is when you're going to see a lunar eclipse. It's when the moon is at just the right Y coordinate on this graph. So remember those two different shadows I talked about. You have the umbra and the penumbra. And the penumbra, the big shadow, when the moon passes into that shadow, sometimes you will get like a penumbral lunar eclipse. And that can be difficult to see, right? Because that shadow isn't so dense. It's not going to block out as much light. And then you can also get a partial lunar eclipse where, you know, only part of the moon is blocked out by the shadow. The really impressive one you want to see is the total lunar eclipse where it's just right to pass into the umbra, you know, that deep center shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the magic happens. And so lunar eclipses are pretty rare. On average, they can happen about 3 times a year, though you can have a year where you don't have any eclipses, any lunar eclipses at all. And then about a third of these are the penumbral ones that are harder to see.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astaproallergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left, look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Cool. And that brings us to solar eclipses. And again, it comes down to three bodies, you know, again, sort of the projector, something in the way of the projector in the screen.
Right.
But in this case, a solar eclipse is occurring when the moon passes in a direct line between the Earth and the sun. So we're the screen as opposed to the individual standing in front of the screen in my projector analogy here. Mm-hmm. And solar eclipses are only possible during the new moon phase. This is when the moon essentially plays monkey in the middle between sun and Earth.
When you normally wouldn't see it.
Right. So what happens here is the moon's shadow travels over the Earth's surface and blocks out the sun's light as seen from Earth. Again, it all comes down to the observer. Because the moon orbits the Earth at an angle, up, as we already discussed, approximately 5 degrees tilted, the moon crosses the Earth's orbital plane only twice a year. And these times are called eclipse seasons because they are the only times when eclipses can occur. So for an eclipse to take place, the moon must be in just the correct phase during an eclipse season, and then that's when the solar eclipse occurs. The condition makes this extremely rare. Now, the moon's shadow, as we already mentioned, you have the central umbra and then the outer penumbra. Depending on which part of the shadow passes over you, you'll see one of three different types of solar eclipses. Because as you've probably noted, if you've done any kind of reading, online where you're like, when's the next eclipse occurring? How am I going to see a solar eclipse?
Yeah, solar eclipse depends on where you are.
Yeah, it depends greatly on where you are. I'm already looking ahead to the next one and I'm thinking, all right, how far do I have to drive?
Right.
I think I'd have to drive to Kentucky to really get a good view of it. And I'm already thinking about my eclipse tourism. Because, yeah, you could get a total solar eclipse. And clearly, this is the one you want to drive for. The entire central portion of the sun is blocked out. This is your big, iconic, oh, my God, the world is ending eclipse, right? But then there's the partial eclipse where only part of the sun's surface is blocked out. And then there's an annular, and this is when only a small ring-like sliver of light is seen from the sun's disk.
Yeah, you can actually observe the sun's corona, sort of like a plasma halo of the sun around the outside of the black disk.
Yeah, which is also pretty, oh my God, the world is going to end.
Yeah.
And that's a solar eclipse. That's how that works.
Yeah, we did our best with words again. Look at a picture.
Yeah, and also I'm going to make sure to link out to our How Stuff Works articles on the landing page for this episode. We have an article about solar eclipses, and we have an article about lunar eclipses. Both of those have illustrations that will really help you get a better grasp on what's happening here, as well as more in-depth explanations.
Right. And we're eventually going to get back to what eclipses mean to us in a kind of like a dark and magical way, but... Mm-hmm. Eclipses also do have scientific significance, and I think we should examine those claims, both the real scientific significance and the ones that have been maybe proposed but not quite validated.
Yeah, indeed, and some that you might not even think about. Like, I had not really thought about the effect of a solar eclipse on terrestrial wind.
Wind.
Yeah, which of course makes perfect sense, right? Because the sun and its effect on the Earth is doing a lot of the work in stirring our atmosphere into the weathered patterns that we perceive.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what wind is exchanging gas from one place to another because of heat differentials. And when you block out the sun, obviously you're creating a kind of disturbance in the normal solar radiation levels you're getting in a certain area.
Indeed. And in 2012, a study from the University of Reading looked into this and found that solar eclipses do, in fact, slow the wind down and make it change directions. This is a team of scientists led by Dr. Suzanne Gray, and they compared hourly measurements of wind speed and direction from 121 weather stations across southern England during the August 1999 total solar eclipse. Then they compared these to a high-resolution weather forecast model that did not account for a solar eclipse. So what they found is that everything lined up on these two different accounts, the model that the computer model that does not have an eclipse, and then reality, which has an eclipse. Everything lines up right until you get to the eclipse point. So they got to see what the weather would have been like without the eclipse occurring at that divergent point. And these were the results. They found that average wind speed across a cloud-free region over southern England dropped by 0.7 meters per second, and that the wind's direction turned counterclockwise by an average of 17 degrees. So effectively, the eclipse was causing the winds to become more easterly, and temperatures also fell by about 1 degree Celsius.
Oh, so did they know the reason why it was changing the weather? Was it what I was saying earlier about changing the temperature and solar radiation, or did it have more to do with gravity from the sun and the moon?
Well, I mean, temperatures fall when there's no sunlight, obviously,
as
we see in our regular play of night and day. So that was expected. Winds slow when atmosphere close to the ground cool, so that was to be expected. But the changes in wind direction were a bit of a surprise.
Huh. I wonder what could cause that.
Well, I mean, a lot of it just comes down to just the complexity of weather models, you know,
right.
And just how many different factors are playing into wind speed and direction.
Right. Butterflies, the sun in New York, you get rain instead of...
I mean, exactly. That's we get the butterfly effect. We get the idea of chaos theory, and it stems out of our attempts to forecast weather in this entirely complex system.
Here's one I've heard.
Okay.
I remember reading somewhere that apparently animals go nuts during an eclipse. Now, is this true or is this a bunch of bunk?
I believe this is a bunch of bunk based on the research that I was looking at. Basically, across the board, there's no preternatural response by animals to eclipse. They simply tend to react to the darkness as if it were occurring during a typical cycle. So, for instance, scientists have observed this in the vertical migration of zooplankton in the ocean due to lunar eclipses, as well as, I mean, countless higher animals when it comes to solar eclipses, because, of course, that's the more drastic change.
That's weird. I mean, intuitively, I would think it would make a big difference. Like if, you know, animals have circadian rhythms and, you know, rhythms that are based on the cycle of night and day and that are tied to all kinds of biological processes, not just sleep and wake, but lots of things in your body.
Mm-hmm.
I would think if the darkness comes before you're expecting it, that would throw you all out of whack.
Well, basically, I mean, it comes down to you have daytime mode and nighttime mode, right? And if it seems like suddenly it's getting dark, well, it's time to shift into nighttime mode.
Huh.
And that's pretty much what a lot of the research out there has shown, that roughly speaking, diurnal animals react as though night were approaching, as demonstrated in, expedited roosting and bedding behavior. And in contrast, animals that are normally active at night, nocturnal, animals like bats and whatnot, they may show the reverse pattern. So they're emerging into the open as if the sky darkens during an eclipse. So, yeah, there's not animals going crazy in the streets. They're not, wolves. They're not howling out of madness. It's just a gentle shift into sort of early nighttime. And then, oops, it's not nighttime after all. Go back to your regularly scheduled program.
Here's something I don't know if I've ever seen addressed in the werewolf literature.
Okay.
What happens during a lunar eclipse? So let's say you're a werewolf. Your transformation is triggered by the appearance of the full moon. Mm-hmm. So full moon's out, but suddenly it passes into the umbra, and you've not got a full moon anymore, at least not got a normal full moon. You've got an eclipsed full moon. What happens to your body?
I would think that wolf mode is canceled at that point.
Yeah?
I would think
you just revert back to a naked human in the woods?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, maybe even more naked than normal, like no body hair. You would be whatever is on the other side of human from the werewolf, almost like a werehuman. A werehuman plus. That would be my guess on that.
You turn into one of those dog robots, the puppy bots.
But, you've hit, of course, on an important question here, because we're talking about how eclipses affect animals. And, of course, the human animal, like that's where we see most of the more impressive effects. Now, we don't turn into werewolves, obviously, because, of course, an eclipse has a huge impact on the way we perceive the universe, how we perceive life on Earth and what it means.
Yeah, it's those portents we were talking about earlier. I mean, we are the animals that go crazy when a solar eclipse happens or a lunar eclipse sometimes.
Indeed. We are the animals that go crazy.
I don't know if you've ever seen, a video of a large crowd gathered to view a solar eclipse. Sometimes there's just, sudden screaming. And people, it's bizarre.
Yeah.
I mean, I would be very impressed to see a lunar eclipse. I don't think I've ever actually watched one, maybe when I was a little kid or something. I don't know. But I wouldn't scream, I don't think.
You don't think, but how can you be for certain? I mean, I've never seen a solar or lunar eclipse myself. Not the full, lunar eclipse, and sort of the full solar eclipse. So, I think I would behave calmly, but maybe I would just really mark out for it. Now, we'll talk more about religion and myth here in a bit after an upcoming break, but according to at least one historical account, according to a Greek historian Herodotus, and only according to him, keep that in mind, Thales of Miletus predicted an eclipse that occurred during the sixth year of war between the Medians and the Lydians, and allegedly, this eclipse resulted in a complete ceasefire. So the eclipse occurs, war has been raging for years and years and years, and then the eclipse occurs and everyone puts down their weapons and they get serious about talking peace. Did it happen? I don't know. This is only Herodotus gives us this account. And if it occurred, we're probably talking about an eclipse on May 28th, 585, as this is when a total solar eclipse was visible in the Aegean and Asia Minor region. But there was no mention of werewolves in his account either. But then sometimes the effects and the ramifications of eclipse go beyond life here on Earth. They go into our understanding of how the universe itself works.
Yeah, this is great. There have actually been examples of people using eclipses as a way to devise an experiment that you couldn't otherwise perform. So, on Earth, we don't have a lot of options for performing experiments that involve incredible amounts of mass or energy. Like now these days we can build hadron colliders and stuff to generate a huge amount of energy in a controlled area, but we didn't always have stuff like that. And we still can't generate, enough mass to simulate the mass of a star or the mass of a planet or something like that. We can only harness so much. But there are very clever ways to use quantities like, for example, the mass of the sun to experimentally verify predictions based on new theories. So I want to take us to 1919 when we had this wonderful new theory from my old friend Alfred Einstein, Albert Einstein, I believe he was called. But his theory was theory of general relativity. So the idea here is that gravity is actually the curvature of what Einstein called space-time, that space and time were sort of part of the same general four-dimensional fabric of the universe, and that gravity was actually the effect of seeing that fabric warped or distorted or bent by a large piece of mass. But how could you test that?
Yeah, because you're basically saying, Einstein's basically saying, a sufficiently massive object is going to bend light.
Yeah, like you could observe it. You could observe the bend in space-time by seeing how the trajectory of a beam of light changes as it goes around a really massive object, but you can't put the sun in a lab.
Yeah, it's like you would need to say, okay, Einstein, go get a sun-sized object, get a bowling ball about that size, get a flashlight, and let's watch the light curve.
Right. But you know, one thing you could do is try to watch what happens when a star passes behind the sun.
Ah.
You could look out toward the sun and see, hey, as the light passing the sun comes toward us, does it get bent an amount by the gravity of the sun that would be a number corresponding to Einstein's theory of relativity? And that would be great if you could check it out, but there's a problem. The sun's too bright.
Ah.
Like, you can't see the light from the stars behind it. At least you certainly couldn't at the time. I'm not sure if we could now, but there might be a way around that. You could look for how the sun bends light coming from stars behind it during a solar eclipse.
Huh.
And that's the solution. So Sir Frank Watson Dyson, an astronomer royal of Britain, conceived this experiment, and then it was carried out by a Sir Arthur Eddington. But what they did was they plotted out the course of an upcoming solar eclipse, and then they sent teams to a couple of locations. One of them was an island off the west coast of Africa called Principe, I believe. And then the other team, I think, was sent to Brazil. And they were supposed to measure what happened when the solar eclipse happened, just to look for that light coming from the star that was passing behind the sun, to see if it bent at just the right amount to experimentally verify Einstein's theory of relativity. And it did. Which, of course, made Einstein an overnight sensation.
So we see a case of the eclipse being the perfect scenario in which to test out a theory regarding mass and the bending of light.
Right. And at the time, there was just, like, no other way we could have tested this.
Yeah, you can't build a model in which to construct it. You have to depend on the model that is reality.
Of course, the experimenters were very lucky that they had, clear weather and stuff when that happened.
Yeah, I mean, that's why they sent out two experiments, like one, two teams to two different locations, because what if one was cloudy, right? You needed a fail-safe.
Yeah, what if they'd both been cloudy? Oh, well, what a mess.
Yeah, imagine picking up the check for that experiment.
None of us would know who Einstein was.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about eclipse mythology. We're not going to do an exhaustive mention of everything, because every culture has some sort of cool eclipse myth, but we'll do some highlights and then talk a little more celestial mechanics before we close it out.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
All right, we're back. So when you're talking about eclipse and mythology and folklore, you do see the reemerging trend of disorder and chaos.
Right. It's like we were talking about earlier, where the sort of rhythm of night and day is about as basic as it gets for a biological organism. Like,
yeah.
Disturbing that cycle is a, I think I called it perverse, and I'm going to stick with that. It is a perversion of what seems to be biologically necessary.
Yeah, I mean, you can basically root most of the major themes in mythology and folklore down to the basic rhythms of life. There's night and day, there's life and death,
yeah.
There's birth, there's disease, and
the cycles of the seasons.
Yeah, the cycles of the seasons. And so you end up personifying these movements and defining features of life. And then, of course, all those gods end up having their own little personal dramas, their own offspring, their own parental issues. And you end up just filling up the entire pantheon and then driving stories out of each one.
So, yeah, we know that the ancient Chinese astronomers were very concerned with being able to predict eclipses. Like, what were some ancient Chinese beliefs about the eclipse?
One that certainly rises to the surface is just the basic belief that the eclipse occurred when a legendary celestial dragon devoured the sun or the moon. And it was actually tradition in ancient China to bang drums and pots and make loud noises during the eclipse to frighten away the dragon. And the tradition of this actually carried on into the 19th century when the Chinese Navy would fire cannons during a lunar eclipse.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. It comes back to what you're talking about, like people, you know, making a lot of noise, sort of freaking out and getting excited during one of these eclipse events. So you can sort of see this tradition as an example of that, where it's a time to make a lot of noise, get excited about what's happening, and to varying degrees apply this mythical context. And as far as records of eclipses go in China, they date back at least to 1600 BCE. We see that by looking at oracle bones from the Shang Dynasty.
Wow. Another really interesting one is the role Eclipse is played in sort of the royal mythology of ancient Assyria. So if you look to Assyria in the first millennium BCE, there was a type of lunar eclipse that was actually considered a bad omen for the reigning king at the time. So it's like, oh, you see this particular type of lunar eclipse and you know the gods have it in for the king. The king's going to die.
That's bad for your political standing. That's bad for the Poles.
Certainly bad for the king.
Yeah.
So what do you do? I mean, well, so you could come up with some kind of like just standard magical rituals to ward off the bad omens. But what if you're afraid that's not going to work?
Well, so basically, how do you get out of cosmic trouble here?
How do you escape your fate?
Yeah.
As dictated by the, you know, the celestial objects, they know more than we do. I mean, so the way they figured out to get around this was a ritual substitute king, or I believe it's pronounced Sharpui. And so what you do is you would basically create a scapegoat king to absorb the evil fate of the reigning king. And so you dethrone the real king, the reigning king, for like 100 days, and you would substitute this fake king to eventually be killed in the king's place. And then once the bad omen is fulfilled, then the actual king can safely return to the throne without having to worry about his fate.
Huh. And I understand that, like, when I first started looking into it, I thought they meant that it was more of like a ritual, it's like sacrifice of the substitute king, but it sounds more and more like the substitute king, quote unquote, dies. So you can imagine some form of royal crier appearing before the people and saying, oh, the substitute king has died in his sleep, thus fulfilling the prophecy and any death-related obligations of our returning king. Let's hear it for King, what's his name?
Ashurbanipal, right?
Ashurbanipal, back in office.
Welcome back.
Yeah, the bad omen is behind us because the substitute king absorbed it all.
Yeah, that substitute king was such a bad king anyway.
It's, I wonder what it would be like to be that substitute king. Would you feel the pressure to really get stuff done? Like, maybe if I really prove myself in my 100 days in office, they'll actually keep me? Or is it just sort of like, well, heck, they're gonna kill me in 100 days. I'm just gonna ride this out in the most hedonistic fashion possible.
Did the substitute king know? Like, did he think he was having the best day ever?
That's true, yeah. Is it just the priests and the king himself that are aware of this scenario?
Yeah, I don't know.
I wonder if there is any fiction out there that explores this trope. If so, I would love to hear about it, because it seems just perfect for exploitation.
Send us that short story.
Yeah. Another example that came to our eyes was that of Apophis in Egyptian religion, ancient Egyptian religion and mythology, and this is a moon serpent. The moon serpent that emerged from the great void at the dawn of time and now lives deep within the Nile. The Nile, not only in the physical sense, but also in sort of the cosmic sense of ancient Egyptian religion.
Sure.
It embodies all the dark aspects of the universe. He's night and death. He's storms and chaos. He conspires with Set, the god of evil. And sometimes he ensnares souls in their journey between this life and the next, engulfing them, and not only just like eating them, but just crushing them into non-existence.
Wow.
Reminding me a bit of The Long Boy in Stephen King's Lissy's story.
Oh, I haven't read that. What is he?
He's basically a cosmic world serpent that lives outside of our reality, and if he eats you, it's like Lovecraftian levels of bad.
Oh, that's cool.
It just crushes you into non-existence.
Stephen King likes those cosmic world-eating serpents.
He's great when it comes to the extra-dimensional entities, no doubt. Of course, this cosmic world serpent from Egyptian mythology, of course he wants to devour the great sun disk that lights our world, which is pulled across the sky by the god Ra in his sunboat. Ra is protected, however, by another serpent, a good one, and almost always escapes the ravenous Apophis. But sometimes he almost succeeds, and that's when we get an eclipse, but he's always made to vomit everything back up again. So in this, we see the traditional trope of eclipse as an example of the forces of chaos and darkness and evil almost winning, but then being beaten away by the forces of order.
You know, I feel like we still have not actually shucked this myth of, like, the monster that eats the sun, because we've got it within the past few decades with Unicron, eating planets.
Yes, Unicron, and we'll come back to Unicron in a minute, because he does line up rather nicely with a particular eclipse entity from Hindu religion.
Let's see. I'm going to see if I can find a good YouTube clip of Unicron eating a planet.
But no, Unicron, Galactus, those guys are very much in keeping with these ancient ideas of cosmic world eaters, cosmic moon and sun eaters.
It is a truly captivating idea. I mean, like, is the sun an entity that can be consumed? I mean, if it could, you could sort of see that as, like, it's like the ultimate empowering agent. It's, you know, it's the pill that you take that gives you ultimate power.
Yeah. But it's also, it's almost kind of this idea too that, like, nothing can actually eat the sun. So
yeah.
If you have an evil being or creature in your cosmology, of course it's going to try to eat the sun, but it can't carry it out. And then
right.
It just falls back to Earth. It falls back to hell or what have you. Now we're kind of jumping around in time a little bit, but just to make sure we hit at least one werewolf example. There is a werewolf from the folkloric traditions of Russia and Belarusia, and this is an individual named Vesislav. The Belarusian werewolf.
Oh, so now are we actually going to find out what happens to a werewolf during the eclipse?
No, sadly not. But no. We'll see how an eclipse factors into the creation of a werewolf.
Okay.
The idea here is that his mother was violated by a serpent, and as a result, Vesislav was born during a solar eclipse. And so he became a mighty warrior in life, kind of a warrior magician, a warrior sorcerer,
mm-hmm.
Battle wizard, if you will. But he also... could turn into a wolf. He was essentially a werewolf and could take on this nocturnal lupine form. Now, he's based on a real guy, based on the real life Vasislav of Polotsk, also known as Vasislav the Sorcerer, Vasislav the Seer, really lived from 1039 to 1101 and is the most famous ruler of the Polotsk and briefly Grand Prince of Kiev from 1068 to 1069. This more mythic, lycanthropic version of him stems from the 12th century Slavic epic, The Tale of Igor's Campaign. And as far as I know, nothing in there tells us what happens to Vasislav during a lunar eclipse.
Man, that would be really cool to be immortalized in, like, epic poetry and turned into a werewolf.
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier. He kind of reminds us of the Starks, right?
Right. He's like Robb Stark.
Yeah.
You know, like, they're a legend. He's actually just a sort of warrior king, but there are legends surrounding him. Oh, he can turn into a wolf in
yeah.
a full moon. And then, of course, there's throat ripping.
Throat ripping, yeah. That's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's a bloody time.
Delicious viscera.
And this brings us to one of my favorite. And again, you know, we're continually to see this trope of the moon or sun-consuming entity. This brings us to the Hindu god Rahu, or Phra Rahu, as he's known in Thailand. And he has just a fabulous story. But he's easily my favorite of all these different eclipse entities, because he was once a proud Asura, a demigod of immense power and hunger. But, you know, he's a bit flawed. He's a little too ambitious. He wants immortality because, within this particular cosmology, demigods are just another realm in the wheel of samsara. So demigods may be super powerful and they may live a long, long time compared to human lives, but they're ultimately going to die.
Right.
So Rahu drinks the divine nectar that's going to give him immortality. But before this gulp full of this magical liquid could pass his throat, all-powerful Vishnu jumps in and decapitates him for the transgression.
Okay, so he cuts his head off, severing the esophagus before it trickles down the esophagus.
Right, before it can actually go all the way down, so just cuts it off there.
Oh, man, that's such a bummer. Like, how low would it have to get to have an effect? Do you have to fully digest it?
I think the idea is kind of like an Achilles kind of a situation.
Yeah.
You know, Achilles is only as powerful as how far he's dipped in the water.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, his heel didn't make it in, so the heel was vulnerable.
Yeah.
So cut him off before the liquid could pass into the body. So the body's gone, but the head has the power. So the idea here is that the power of the nectar makes the disembodied head of Rahu immortal.
Oh, man.
And so this cleaved and fallen god continues to seek his revenge on the two planetary deities who ratted him out to Vishnu, and that's the sun and the moon.
Mm.
So as such, ravenous Rahu regularly ascends into the sky and attempts to swallow the sun or the moon. But since he's disembodied, his meal falls back out again. So he succeeds. He eats that moon. He eats the sun, but he has no body. It's just a head with some neck flesh. So he swallows it and comes right back out the next step.
That is genius.
Yeah.
Like, that is an awesome myth.
Now, in Thailand, he's seen as more cut off at the stomach, however, as opposed to just a head. So he's more of just a half god instead of just a head of a god in those motifs. Now, where this gets interesting, an area of this myth that I really find fascinating, is that you see this exchange between science and myth regarding Rahu and his status. So there's always been less conflict between science and Hinduism due to a variety of reasons, but you can hone in on distinct linguistic differences between teleological and causative whys. Mm. So just the language of talking about why something happens. There's the why as in, like, what was the actual cause of this event, and then there's the why in the sense of what is its reason from a cosmological standpoint?
Oh, it sounds almost like a parallel between causality and synchronicity.
Yeah, yeah, in a sense, because it's kind of like if I say, why did I get sick? You could say, well, the reason you were sick is because you ate that food at that restaurant last night that was a little off.
It had E. coli in it.
Yeah. And then there's the why that you would ask, like, why, God, am I allowed to get sick on this most important day of my life when I have this job interview and my marriage on the same afternoon?
It's to humble you.
Yeah, exactly. So the idea here is that in English especially, there's more room for confusion here between your whys. Whereas in Hinduism, they're depending on linguistic models that have a clear distinction between those whys.
I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. Any way you shake it, though, we do see this interesting interplay between Rahu and astronomy of the time, because Indian astronomy was pretty advanced. And his scientist Rajesh Koshar discusses in his paper Rahu and Ketu in Mythological and Astromological Context, treatments of the disembodied Rahu actually evolved with the scientific knowledge of the time.
Huh.
Yeah. So go back 2,000 years, and Indian astronomers divided the cosmos into 7 geocentric planets, or graha, and then they set aside particularly disastrous phenomena like meteors, comets, and eclipses, and they called those utpada. So on one hand, you had cyclical order, the graha, the planets, and then you had just chaos and dire omen in the forms of utpada. But of course, as we know now, eclipses follow a pattern. We can predict them. We can prove it out.
Right.
They're actually more in line with order than in chaos.
But it's not necessarily easy to see that pattern. It's a pattern that you might only notice after you've collected multiple generations worth of data.
Yeah. It took a while before someone realized that. And in 499 CE, the great Indian mathematician, astronomer Aryabhata introduced a mathematical theory of eclipses that really pretty much nailed it. Just our 2 lunar nodes, Earth shadows and Moon shadows, so there are no demons required.
Okay.
But, of course, that means that Rahu needs a promotion, along with his headless body that ends up being known as Ketu. So instead of them being chaotic Utpada, they are upgraded to ordered Graha.
Okay.
So while they're not actually considered planets, they don't get like full planetary status because, of course, they're not planets. It's just the way things are lining up. They took on the distinction of being shadow planets.
So that they graduated from becoming sort of like intruders on the cosmic plane to more like a shadowy residents.
Yeah,
on the cosmic plane.
Yeah, they were really seen as more. They said, "Hey, we can't really classify the eclipse as just pure chaos because clearly there's a pattern. Clearly it's part of the ordered system of our planets." And they realized this even in 499.
I'm sensing more parallels with Unicron.
I mean, indeed, when you look at Unicron especially, Unicron and Rahu are basically the same entity, right down to just being disembodied heads, right? Because what did Unicron do in the 86 Transformers movie? Tried to eat the Earth, right? Transformers stopped him and he's just reduced to a head.
Wow.
Yeah. So I've looked into it. I found no clear example where someone says, yeah, we based a Unicron on a Hindu god or Hindu entity. But it seems there's just too much coincidence there to ignore.
But of course, it's not just the ancient religious cosmology that assigns true, like, magical significance to eclipses. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are still religious movements today that are looking for the religious significance of eclipses. One example that I remember hearing about is the so-called blood moon prophecy that's popular in some circles of evangelical Christianity these days.
Yeah, the idea here is that it revolves around a tetrid series of lunar eclipses. That's four lunar eclipses within a cycle. You know, three is rare enough, but here you would have four showing up in a row. And it only occurs a few times within a century. For example, in this century, it occurred in 2003, 2004, 2014, and, a few more times before the turn of the next century. So it's a rare enough account that you'll end up, you know, hitting the jackpot with four.
Okay, but, like, why is this popular right now?
Well, it all comes down to a 2013 book, Four Blood Moons, Something is About to Change. Or, let me say, Four Blood Moons, colon, Something is About to Change.
That sounds like a great, like, rock album title.
Yeah. It did not come from rock and roll, though. It came from the pastor of the Cornerstone Megachurch in San Antonio, Texas, John Hagee.
Oh, I know John Hagee.
You do? Okay. Yeah.
Not personally.
But, yeah, you see his picture. You look him up, you'll go, oh, that guy from
Yeah, I've
TV.
I've seen him preaching on television.
Okay. You don't know him personally?
No.
Okay. So Hagee suggests that there's a link between a new total lunar eclipse, a tetrad, and the biblical prophecy about the end times.
Okay.
So it's certainly a case, yes, that we're still looking to the movements of the sun and moon. We're still looking at the eclipse. And even with all of our modern scientific understanding of what's actually happening, if we're trying to understand, like, this wider sense of not only why is that are things occurring in the universe in that causative sense, but also in the grander magical sense and the meaningful sense, you know, we can't help but look to the movement of the sun and the moon and look to these anomalies that occur.
Yeah, I think there's something very interesting about this historical progression of us seeing eclipses originally as sort of like a strange, unpredictable events that violated our sense of patterns, and then finally coming to understand them as part of larger and longer patterns. It's sort of a microcosm of the whole progression of science in a way. Mm-hmm. Like, taking events that seem to represent chaos and disorder and then fitting them into the system of order that you finally come to understand.
And, of course, this analysis of eclipse and obsession with eclipse continues on into present-day fiction, or fiction of the modern era. For instance, Asimov's Nightfall, which exists, of course, is both a short story and there's a full novel version that he did with Robert Silverberg.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, but it concerns a fictional planet. It's called Lagash in the short story and Kalgash in the novel. And this fictional planet, very much like Earth for the most part, you know, like a sci-fi Earth, you can think of it as kind of almost like a Star Trek Earth, where it's basically Earth that things, there are a few factors at play that make it interesting.
Right, you've got some wrinkles on your head or something.
Yeah, so it's kind of like that, except the wrinkles here are that the planet has six suns, which keep the planet illuminated in varying levels of daylight all the time.
That sounds like too many suns.
It does sound like too many suns, but the result is that there's no total darkness on the planet. And so, on one hand, the idea of there being total darkness just seems like no one can buy, for the most part, no one can buy that. They're like, how would that even work? Like, the creatures depend on light. Mm-hmm. If there were periods of darkness, that it would just be devastating. But it also means that no one has ever seen the stars.
Wow.
And so, but then there, when they start looking back, through historical accounts and some individuals are, you know, trying to figure out how celestial mechanics work, there's a belief that every 2,000 years or so, darkness comes to the planet of Lagash or Kalgash, and with it falls whole civilizations.
You know, I can almost see that kind of thing in that scenario being a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost kind of like the idea of the eclipse blown up.
Yeah.
And also kind of reversed, that the world has always bathed in varying levels of light, but then every 2,000 years there is a night. And to a world that has never known night, would it just be madness? Would it be the banging in the streets times 1,000? Like, how would we deal with that? And that's what Asimov's novel explores. Or on a much simpler level, you can look at Mark Twain's A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, in which a time-traveling Yankee saves his life in the Middle Ages by remembering the occurrence of an eclipse and claiming to have caused it.
Oh, well, I mean, you could tie that into events in real history, actually, where, you know, people have obviously been able to use their knowledge of the ordered sequence of eclipse cycles to impress people, right? If you know that an eclipse is coming and other people have no idea that eclipses are on a schedule, basically, you can appear to have tremendous magical power.
Yeah, and even today, if you work in a, you know, kind of uninformed workplace, like nobody's really reading Scientific American or anything,
right,
or the newspaper, you might be able to pull this one off still. Wait for the next solar eclipse, go to work, and then claim to be a wizard. You'll surely get that promotion you've always wanted.
Yeah. I mean, that's a rule. That's business 101. Yeah, always promote a wizard.
That's just solid advice right there. All right, so there you have it. The science of eclipse, you know, a brief study of some of the mythology surrounding the eclipse, and just what it means to humanity as a whole. If you would like to explore more on this topic, again, check out that landing page for this episode, and you'll find that at stufftoblowyourmind.com, along with all the other episodes we've ever recorded, along with videos, blog posts, links out to social media accounts, you name it.
And if you've got a story you'd like to share about an eclipse you've ever seen or a fascinating eclipse mythology you've read about, please email it to us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.